ॐ पार्थाय प्रतिपोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृतितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्ददामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वैषिणी.
We'll start with verse 10 and move right on to verse 11. We did 10 last time, but I want to say a few more words about it. Chapter 2, verse 10.
Tamuvacha hrishikeshaha prahasanniva bharata Sena yor ubhayor madhye, vishidantam idam vachaha.
And Sanjaya here is addressing Dhritarashtra, right, telling him Sanjaya uvacha from the previous verse. So Sanjaya is telling Dhritarashtra what Krishna said to Arjuna. Right? So that's why in the previous verse, verse 9, it says Sanjaya uvacha. Right? So He Bharata, the name for Dhritarashtra, He Bharata. Hrishikeshaha said to him, Tam uvacha Hrishikeshaha. Hrishikesha, Krishna said to him. We did it last week. I'll do it quickly for you. Tam uvacha Hrishikeshaha prahasan iva bharata. Senayoho ubhayoho madhye vishidantam idam vachaha. Okay? So here, Hrishikeshaha, prahasan, present participle, eva, as though. So Hrishikesha, Krishna, prahasan, as though smiling, right? Like a smile on his face, but you couldn't believe he was smiling. as though smiling, prahasan eva, tam uvacha, to him, uvacha said. So Krishna said to him, to Arjuna, as though smiling, senayoho ubayoho madhye. Madhye, locative singular, in the middle of, madhya means in the middle. In the middle, senayoho ubayoho, genitive duals. In the middle of both armies, ubaya means both. Sena is an army, okay? So senayoho ubayoho madhye, in the middle of the two armies, of both armies, the Duryodhana and his group on the one side, the Kauravas and the Pandavas on the other. So here, Arjuna and Krishna have their chariot right in the middle of the two, and Arjuna has just spent quite a bit of time telling Krishna, giving all of his logic as to why this is an impossible situation and he couldn't fight, right? So, having done that, he sat down in verse 9, having finished saying everything he had to say to the Lord, he sat down and said, I will not fight. I can't fight. And he became quiet. Okay. So then the Lord said to him, seated there in the middle of the two armies, said to him, who was Vishidantam. Vishidantam is a present participle in the accusative singular. So the participles for my Sanskrit students, you haven't learned participles yet. Okay, it's coming soon. But this present participle, when you have a present participle, it means the person is grieving while doing something else. So Arjuna is sitting. The verb is Arjuna sits on the chariot. But what is he doing while he's sitting? He's grieving, right? So Krishna said these words to Arjuna, who is grieving, in the middle, sitting there in the middle of the two armies. Vishidantam, he was grieving. Okay, everybody see what that is? Present participle. So, the prahasan is also a present participle. Krishna said these words to Arjuna. But Krishna, while he was saying the words, uvacha, Krishna said to Arjuna, tam uvacha Arjunaha, Hrishikeshaha. Hrishikesha said to him, to Arjuna, but while he was saying it, he was as though smiling. Present participle. So while he was doing the main action, he was doing something else. So smiling, as though smiling, he said these words to Arjuna, who was grieving. Right? So Krishna was smiling, Arjuna was grieving, and both of them were sitting there in the middle of the battlefield. Okay? So idam vachaha means these words. But it's in the singular. Idam vachaha means literally this vachaha, this statement. But in English, we just said these words. This is what Krishna said, right? Said to Arjuna. So you can imagine, and we'll see the way Krishna unfolds the Bhagavad Gita now. This vision. Now it's the Vedanta. He's going to give him the whole vision of Vedanta. But one thing that we'll appreciate as we go along is Krishna is teaching Arjuna, right? He's teaching this person who is in this particular situation, who has come to this mukshutvam, who has come to this understanding, this desire for shreyas, this desire for knowledge, which has been born out of this situation, right? So Krishna is going to use this situation and everything that Arjuna has felt and has caused him to come to this kind of abyss, you know, of not knowing at all what to do, this place of utter confusion around what is dharma and not knowing at all what is shreyas or what is proper behavior or how can I possibly be free or do the right thing in the situation like this, to come to the point of asking Krishna, what is absolute shreyas? You know, it means what is self-knowledge? Sisha and self-shreyas means self-knowledge. When one surrenders to a teacher and asks for shreyas, they're asking for liberation, for self-knowledge. And so here, he has now, Arjuna has shown in the way that he laid out the whole situation, he's shown to Krishna a lot of things. He's shown sensitivity. He's shown dharma, you know, his understanding of dharma, his understanding of duty, you know, and then his care and his love. So many qualities have come out as he's been unfolding this whole thing. And then on top of that, what has come through through all of that and this difficult situation is his mumukshutvam and his now recognizing Krishna for what Krishna is really, right? Seeing Krishna as the one who could really answer these questions and give him self-knowledge. So really seeing Krishna as now not just as Bhagavan but as his teacher. And so now, in later on in the Bhagavad Gita, there's a beautiful verse that says, all my devotees are close to me, those who seek me for security, those who seek me because of their sorrow, those who seek me for pleasure. But the one who is closest to me is the jnani, right? The one who seeks me for myself. Right? And so, and there's another part of that, the mumukshu, the one who seeks to know me. And so those ones are the dearest to me. Because it's not as though, would you please, I beg of you, please give me a new car. There's nothing wrong with that, you know. But there's a difference between propitiating someone for something and wanting to know, to have a relationship with you. You know? What is primary is, please, Dad, give me a new car, type of thing. Or what is primary is, wanting to know you and wanting to know what the truth is. So there's a, Bhagavan talks about that later in the Bhagavad Gita. We'll see when we get there. But here, now, Arjuna is asking the Lord, you know, please accept me as your Sisha and teach me this, what is Shreyas. And so that's a big thing for Krishna. So Krishna has a smile on his face. It's a smile, you know, Shankara doesn't say too much about that smile. Swamiji said a lot of different things about it, but you can say, if you put yourself in that position, it's a smile of appreciation, you know, for who Arjuna is as a person, and the joy for him coming to this point where Krishna can really give him this knowledge, you know. So it's also an appreciation you'll see with this next verse. There's such a display of knowledge on Arjuna's part here in terms of Dharma, in terms of the creation. And there's such self-ignorance. So it's quite a mix. You know, there's wonderful Dharma, but all of it is taking this creation to be real and myself to be the karta. So the whole of the vision is not there. So while there's Dharma and intelligence and compassion and wisdom and care and confusion, there's also a lack of self-knowledge. So big piece is missing. And so Krishna sees all of that at the same time. So I see that smile as something being feeling so pleased and so loving and so tickled at the same time, and also kind of understanding the human problem. There's a smile around the human problem that everybody has until they have self-knowledge. You know, and now he's in a position to really kind of free Arjuna of that. So it's a very beautiful thing that little prahasaniva is included in this verse, because it says a lot in terms of what takes place between that teacher-student relationship on the side of the teacher, on the part of the teacher. So, with that, he begins teaching with this next verse. So, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Asochan Anvasochastvam, Ashochan Anvasochastvam, Prajnavadams Chapashase, Prajnavadams Chapashase, Gatasun Agatasuncha, Gatasun Agatasuncha, Nanasochanti Panditaha, Nanasochanti Panditaha. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. Bhagavan is the Bhagavan comes from a vat ending on Bhagavat. Bhagavan is the nominative singular. Bhagavan Uvacha. Bhagavan said, then Sandhi, Ashochan Anbishochaha Twam. Prajnavadan Cha Bhashase. Gata Asun Agata Asun Cha. Na Anushochanti Panditaha. Actually, I think it's Asu. Sorry, Asu. Gata Asun Agata Asun Cha. Na Anushochanti Panditaha. Okay. Let's look at the grammar here for a minute. Ashochan, accusative plural, like Raman. Ashochan comes from the root shuch. Shuch means to grieve, to be in sorrow, to grieve. If I put an a before it, it's going to be that which to not grieve. But shuch becomes shocha as a potential participle. Ashochan means those who do not deserve to be grieved over. those who do not deserve grief, those who should not be grieved for. It's potential participle. So the un negates the such. So those potential participle, accusative plural, those who should not be grieved. Unbesochaha, unbesochaha. You are grieving, you have grieved. We can take it in the present, but it's past. You have grieved, unbesochaha, twam is you. You have grieved over, same root, shuch, down past tense. You have grieved, but we would say in English probably you are grieving. You have been grieving, right? You have been grieving over those who do not deserve grief. Ashochan, unvashochaha, that's anushuch becomes unvashochaha in the past tense. You are grieving over those who do not deserve grief. Pragnavadan, pragnavada means the words of the wise, accusative plural, pragnavadan, like Raman. Bhashase, twam bhashase, and you are speaking, right? And you are speaking the words of the wise. Words, you can even say words of wisdom. You're, two things are happening here. You're grieving over that those who do not deserve grief, and you're speaking words, the words of the wise. You're speaking as though you're a wise person. Gata asun, agata asun cha. Okay. Gata asun, accusative plural. Those whose breath, the asu is the breath, those whose breath has gone, gata, past passive participle. Gata asun, those whose breath have gone, the ones who have died. Agata asun, those whose asu, whose breath, whose life force, agata, has not gone. So those who have died and those who have not died. See the cha? Gata asun, agata asun cha. Those who have died and those who have not died. Na anushochanti. They do not grieve. Na plural, third person plural. Na anushochanti. They do not grieve. Huda panditaha, pundits. And Shankara gives a beautiful definition of the pundit here. The pundits, the wise people, na anushochanti, they don't grieve for the living or the dead. Right? Now, hey Arjuna, you're speaking the words of a wise person. You're speaking words of wisdom. Jesus, he's talking all about dharma. He's talking all about protecting the kula. You know, what happiness is there to, if I were to kill all of my family, what possible happiness could there be if we destroy the dharma? So many wonderful words he's saying. And then at the same time, he's full of grief, grieving over that which does not deserve to be grieved over. Okay. And then he says, people, the pundits, wise people, they don't do this. They don't grieve over the living and the dead. So something is wrong here. You're confused. So he said, you're confused. But now, think of this. This is Krishna's, what we call the pratignya. Krishna can't just say this and walk away. Right? He's making a huge statement here. Because think of Arjuna's condition and the situation. They're standing in the middle of the battlefield. You know? And Arjuna has been completely distraught over the fact that he's going to be killing all of these people. You know? He's completely distraught. And Krishna comes now and says, you're grieving over that which doesn't deserve grief. The pundits do not grieve over the living or the dead. Okay? That means Krishna has a lot of explaining to do here. He has a lot of explaining to do because we have to remember, Arjuna doesn't have self-knowledge at this point. You know, he knows the Vedas. He comes from the Vedic culture. He knows the Dharma. You know, he knows there's supposed to be a Brahman that's the truth of everything. He doesn't know what that means. You know? And so Krishna is now going to teach him what all of that means. And so here there's a couple of levels. But Krishna makes an absolute statement here. The pundits, not anisochanti, they don't grieve after the living or the dead. Okay, so one thing that has to be understood, and Shankara takes care of this in the Bhasha, and these are the little types of lines that I like to collect. They're definitions that Shankara sometimes makes definitions of things that are really important. And here what he says for pundit, he says, pandaha, or panda, atmavishya, buddhihi, yesham tehi panditaha. He says, those whose buddhi, those who have knowledge of the self. Buddhi means knowledge. For whom there is knowledge, knowledge of what? Atmavishya. For those who have knowledge of the self, right? Those people are pundits. So the panda, atmavishya, buddhihi. Panda means wisdom. So panda means wisdom. Panda means buddhihi. But the buddhi, the knowledge of what? Atmavishya. The knowledge whose object, the object of knowledge is the self. So those who have self-knowledge, those are pundits. Right? Now remember, also, so wisdom. Those who have knowledge, those who have wisdom, panda, wisdom of what? Wisdom of the Atma. Those people are pundits. Those people are wise. Now, when you say those who have self-knowledge, what does that mean? It means those who have knowledge that I am the whole. Right. Those people are wise. Because if you don't have knowledge that I am the whole, right, it's not just the Atma as, oh, I am pure consciousness. The Atma, to know yourself is to know that I am the whole. Right? And those people are wise. If a person does not know I am the whole, then that person knows themselves. If you're not the whole, then you're a part of the whole. You're either the whole, or you're a part of the whole. If you're a part of the whole, then you're this identified with this body, mind, sense organs, and your ahankara, the I notion, means the ego. You become what we call a karta and a bhokta. Karta means you're somebody who has doership. I am responsible for this. I do this, and I accrue these karmas. And these karmas, then these karma polas, I become the bhokta. I'm the enjoyer of these. So I am in myself, the ahankara, my I notion, lands on myself as a karta and a bhokta. I am a doer and I'm an enjoyer. I am an entity within this creation. I am different from you and I am different from Ishvara. The panda, the one who is a pundit, the pandita, that person does not say, I'm a karta, I'm a bhokta. That person says, I am the whole. To say I am the whole means that you have to know the relationship between the subject and the object, right? You have to know, in fact, that the subject and the object are one. You have to be able to say I am both the subject and the object, right? So that's the wholeness. If you have that vision, then you have wisdom. If you don't have that wisdom, as in the Mundaka Upanishad we saw in the Katha Upanishad also, you're walking in the dark. It's like the blind leading the blind. Because for you, even though you may think you are wise, right, in fact, you're living in darkness because you don't know the self, which is the whole. You don't know yourself, and not knowing yourself, you don't know the whole. And so, in fact, the panditium, what we call the wisdom that you have, is a false wisdom that we call mithyajnanam. Mithyajnanam means that the knowledge that you're understanding, the cognition that you have, the understanding that you have is not true. It's operational, though. Mithyajnanam, it's a false cognition, it's a false understanding, but it's quite operational. Like, what I mean by that, if I see, have a cognition of a snake, which is actually a rope, my cognition, though, is of the snake, that's mithyajnanam. It's operational in the sense that I'll jerk away from it, I'll respond to it, I'll have emotions around it. So that I'm reacting off of that cognition. The kartritvam, the doership, Let me just tell you all something. Remember we learned the ra ending nouns? We've just learned them. Kartra, bhoktra. Okay. So that ra ending noun shows doership. So if I say kartra, it's a doer. Bhoktra, enjoyer. Right? Gantra, that tra ending. One who goes, a goer. Right? Thrashtra, a seer, one who sees. So this ra ending noun. So here you have, because you hear Swamiji says this all the time. That's why I want you to recognize it. A kartra. It's like the ER. In English, you know, you put ER into a verb. The doer, the walker, the seer, the talker. That's the tra, the ra ending. Kartra, boktra, gantra. Okay? So that tra ending noun shows doership, the ER. Okay? So now, if I say kartra tvam, the state of being a doer or doership, you know, like the ness or the doership or the state of being, kartra tvam, the state of being a doer, bhoktra tvam, the state of being an enjoyer. So if you listen to Swamiji's tapes, these will come all of the time, these tvams. Tvams means the state of being. Kartra, doer. Bhoktra, enjoyer. The samsari, the one who's labeled as a samsari, is one who has kartritva and bhoktritva. Doership and enjoyership. That means that your ahankara, the I notion, this I am, is identified with the body and the mind and the sense organs. Right, so when you say I am, you might say in identification with these different upadis, like I am my mind, I am a thinker, these are all the ra endings, right? I am a thinker, I am a feeler, right? I am, or in my, with my sense organs, I'm a seer, I am a hearer, right? So this is the kartritvam. Then as I enjoy my experience, I have my experiences, I am sad or I am happy or I'm in responding to the experiences in a certain way, that's I'm enjoying the experiences positively or negatively. That's the bhoktritvam. So what if you take that doership to be you? If you take the doership to be you, then sometimes you are doing this, sometimes you're unable to do this, sometimes you're happy, sometimes you're sad. That's your reality, you know. That's where the ahankara is landing. The ahankara, the I notion, lands on this upadhi. Such a person is in the dark in terms of knowing who I am or what is really going on. And so the panditim, that state panditim, the state of being wise, is fallacious. It's a mithya panditim, right? It's a false panditim, because the truth of what's going on is completely unknown. So the word pandita, here Shankara is making clear, when we use this word, what is talked about is somebody who knows the whole, knows that has knowledge of the Atma, and the Atma as the Atma is. It says knowledge of the Atma as Brahman. Now, just a little aside on that, even in India, when we use the word pundit, you can use the word pundit, and often it's used just relatively. Like he's a musician, he's a great pundit. You know, he's a pundit in science or in mathematics. He's a Sanskrit pundit. We're using the term just a scholar. But here in the context of this Bhagavad Gita and how Krishna is using the word, Shankara is defining pundit as one who has the wisdom of Atmajnana, right? Because it's only a person who has the Atmajnana who is not going to be grieving. The one who sees a much, much bigger picture that's not going to be grieving. Another thing, I read Swamiji's commentary on this. He said something I thought was really nice about in terms of how Krishna was responding in this first verse. Arjuna is grieving over all of the people who are going to die. Right? And so when somebody dies, we feel quite confident in sending a sympathy card. Right? We feel confident in sending a sympathy card because the person, the family, you would expect the family to be grieving. You wouldn't expect to be, oh, thank God, so-and-so died or we got rid of these people. You don't really think like that. You think of, you know, losing family or your family and your teachers and all this, that the person would be in deep grief. So in the world, the loss of family or the loss of your teachers, you know, the loss of your loved ones, is expected to cause grief, right? Otherwise, you would have to, in relative situations, you may lose your job, and you may be feeling, thank God, I've finally been released from this job. Now I can do something else. I couldn't make myself quit. They finally got rid of me, and now I'm free. Yeah. Normal things that come and go, you're not certain whether that's good or bad. Or you're not certain whether it's good or bad, right? But if it's loss of family like that, you would expect there to be grief. That would be a natural reaction. And so here, Arjuna's grief is something that people can completely relate to, right? And Krishna is now responding to what is an expected and natural human emotion that Arjuna is feeling. Arjuna, it is nothing wrong with Arjuna to be feeling terrible grief at the thought of killing the ones that he deeply loves. And in fact, the ones that he would fight to preserve the kingdom for. Of course he's feeling overwhelming grief because he's a sensitive person and he has empathy and he has a big heart. And of course he's overwhelmed with grief. And it's in this condition that he's overwhelmed with the grief that would be expected for any sensitive or normal person. Krishna is now saying, you're grieving for that which does not deserve grief. So that's a huge thing to say.
Shocking.
It's shocking to say. Because if anything deserves grief in the world, it is this. This is what you would grieve for. And this extreme situation that is undoubted in terms of the grief it would cause, then Krishna says, you're speaking like a wise person and yet you're grieving for that which does not deserve grief. A person who has knowledge, a wise person, a pundit, he knows the self, na anusochanti, says, they don't grieve for those who have lost their breath. For those for whom the breath is gone means they've left this body. For those who are still living, they don't grieve. Another couple, one thing in the Bhasha. When Shankara explains the nasochaha, asochaha, what he says to what is being referred to, he says, Bhishma dronadiyaha. Sadvrittitvat, paramartasvarupena chanityatvat. He says, Arjuna's grieving by name for Bhishma and Drona and his teachers who are so beloved to him. So here Shankara says, these people, Bhishma and Drona and all of these, they don't deserve grief. They're asochaha. First, tadvrittitvat. Because of their conduct, these are they're considered Mahapurushas, great dharmis, people who are extraordinary Mahapurushas, you know, who have extraordinary dharma. And so when these people are killed, they'll only go, when they die, according to their karma, they'll be well taken care of. That's what it meant. Sadvrita means they've lived a good life. You don't have to worry about these people dying and then going to Naraka. These are Mahapurushas. They've lived a good life, you know, and they will be rewarded. They'll have good, their karmas will be good. So you don't have to worry, you know, that what these people are have made these mistakes, and that if we kill them now, they're just going to go off to hell and have to suffer for all of this time or this type of thing. No. From who these people are, just in terms of their karma, they'll be fine. Krishna will talk about this later, but Shankara's bringing it here now. Then he says, Paramartha Swarupena Chanityatvat. And because, from the standpoint of the Paramartha Swarupa, the real nature, who they really are, they are Nitya, Nityatva. Because of being free from time, from the standpoint of themselves, of the self, they're free from time. They're Nitya. Nitya means, if you can translate as eternal, but eternal gives that sense of ongoing eternity. Whereas if you say timeless, what that means is that the self that you are in reality never changes. Nothing can touch it. Right? Things come and go. All things come and go within samsara, within the creation. But the self never comes and goes. So from the standpoint of yourself, there's no birth and death. There's no change. There's nothing. You are the whole. There's nothing that's going to happen to you at all. Zero. And from the standpoint even of Bhishma and Drona and these people who are so beloved to you, these dharmis, you know, nothing will happen to them. They're Mahapurushas. They'll be fine. In terms of their karma, they'll go and they'll get a better birth. So, in terms of karma, they'll also be fine. So why are you grieving? Everybody's going to die. So if there's not, you can't be too impractical about this. There's certain realities. When you say this, this asu, it says in the tradition that every jiva, because of the prarabdha, you take this birth, you have so many breaths. Your prarabdha karma allots you so many breaths, right? And you don't know when that last breath is going to be, right? But when that last breath is, this body will drop, and this karma is over. It could happen at any time, right? It could happen in the next second. It could happen in a week. It could happen at any time. Nobody knows. But everybody knows one thing, and that it for sure, it will happen. And everybody has their own death, whatever that is. They have their own birth, they have their own life, and they have their own death. And it's all part of the package. There's not one person that is going to escape that. And that part, in fact, they look at life, they look at it as sixfold. The jati, you're born, and now you've come into being. Take your birth, you come into being. Then you grow, start growing up. Then you go through your transformation, puberty is what they mean. Then you go, you know, you've gone through your puberty, and so now you're formed as an adult. And then you go on for that way for a while, and slowly you begin to decay, and then you die. Right? So it's kind of this little arc, like that. You know? Birth, death. And so, in fact, when they say, often they'll say, jaya mrityu, you know? Birth and death, and they just expect you to include all of the others in between. You know, everybody has birth, everybody has death, and there's this progression that goes on in between. At any time between this, any time after your birth, there can be death. We don't know. It depends on what the prarabdha is. And so now, say are we going to grieve that? Are we going to grieve that there's death? If you're going to grieve that there's death, you're going to be grieving for something that nothing can be done about. You know, you're grieving over the nature of creation itself. And so that's a sad state of affairs. If we're going to grieve over that which is the reality for every living thing comes into being and goes out of being, right? That's an impractical grief. And so, therefore, most people realize, okay, we have to die at some point, and so let's live our life to the fullest as we can. So now, say if you live your life to the fullest as you can, and you look back on your life, and you've lived a good life, then from a Hindu point of view, there's no fear, because when you, this life is over, then you'll get a better life next time. You'll enjoy the fruits of your karma, and then you'll take another life next time. But that's kind of a practical attitude. So where's the grief over that? If you start grieving over that, then it becomes very impractical, right? But then on a different level, than the level of panditium, where is the grief in terms of self-loss? Because from the standpoint of yourself, from Paramartika standpoint, there's no time, there's no change, there is no death. There's no experience of death. In fact, it doesn't even exist. Death is misnomer the right word? There is no death. The experience doesn't exist. Right? For the experience of death to exist, you have to die. See what I mean? This body will die. In fact, everything about this body is dying all the time. The cells are reproducing, everything's changing. It's the same for the entire creation. The entire creation is in a state of constant flux, so it's being born and dying all of the time. But now, the question is this. Is the self of the plant, for instance, is the self of the worm, is the self of the animal, is the self of the individual, is the self of the rock, dying for there to be death? Right? You see what I'm saying? If the one that is there, no matter what the form, I don't care what the form is, it could be any plant or any animal or any insect or the creation itself. If the being never experiences death, as these things go on changing, coming and going, where is the experience of death? Who is having the experience of death? So the experience of death doesn't exist for anybody. Even if somebody feels, say somebody who's a complete atheist and believes the only reality that there is, the only reality that there is this physical matter that we experience. And when this body dies, that is the end. There will be no more me. There will be no more experience. When this body dies, there will be non-existence. That's the end. That's a person who's a materialist and atheist, the Charvaka, we call them in Sanskrit. So say that is their belief, right? Okay, so now, of course, their time comes, just like everybody else, right? And so when their body dies, when the body dies, what do you think their experience is going to be? It's going to be, oh, I was wrong. because there's no change for the self. You know, put it like this, just to make you really make sure you understand. Say, I love using the dream. Okay, say in the dream, okay, there's a character in the dream, right, who's a total atheist, right? And that character gets sick and dies, right? So they're dead, right? What is the death experience for that character? There is no death experience. What if another person, you know, they're in a hospital. The atheist is in the hospital dying. The jnani is in the hospital dying. The bhakta is in the hospital dying. They're all in the hospital dying. Okay? And they all die at the same time. Okay? Does anybody die? The atheist thinks, I'm going to die. The bhakta thinks, I'm going to go to heaven. The jnani thinks, whatever. The jnani knows myself. Okay? But in terms of the reality, does the atheist have any more of a death experience than the jnani or than the bhakta? No, because the self is the same, right? Mithya, the creation comes, and everything in the creation comes, is sustained and resolves, right? So every individual within the creation is of the same maya with the same self. In reality, there is only one whole, When the jnani says, the pundit says, I am the whole, that's only one who is, there is only one who is the whole. And there's not two. It's not like, say, you say, I am the whole, and you say, I am the whole, and I say, I am the whole. Okay, now there's three wholes. No, there's not three wholes. It's the recognition that I am you. Right? That I am you. And this I that I am, which is the I that you are, that I is the whole. And that I that I am, never goes through any birth or death. So there is, if that I that is there and is the very being of all that we experience in all of this Maya, then where is the experience of death for anything? Because the being, which is actually there, the very substance of all of this, never experiences any type of death at all or any type of change. So the experience of death does not exist. See what I'm saying? The experience of death does not exist because the experience of change does not exist. The experience of non-existence does not exist. Right? So the being that you are now is the being that you've always been and the being you will always will be. It's free from time. So here, that's why Krishna says the pundits, they don't grieve for the living or the dead. They also don't grieve for the living or the dead in terms of the transmigrating jiva. Because the transmigrating jiva, here is now, here, living karma, you know, and later will be living according to the karma. And all are contained, all experiences are contained in one infinite order of Ishwara. You know, infinite in terms of size, infinite in terms of laws, infinite in terms of the organization of all, by laws I mean that infinite order. So everything exists as part of that infinite order, and it goes on and on and on, and this is one moment of that. This life that we're experiencing as a jiva is one moment of an infinite, beginningless order. So this is one birth of how many births? Beginningless. One birth of beginningless births. And what puts you in this moment of time? The infinite karmas. Right? And so with that vision, this body, mind, sense organs is part of this situation, and we are all enjoying right now a collective karma, right? A karma in which all of us are equally participating, because here we are. We're all in the same room. Right? So there's a collective karma for us in this room. There's a collective karma for us in Berkeley, in California, in the United States at this time, you know, with this government at this time, with this situation at this time. It's a collective order that we are born into at this particular time. And this life is one of many. And so it's not a question. It's a little bit of a side, but it's very connected. This life that you have with this set of experiences is one of many. Number one. Number two, you can only have so many experiences at a given time, in a given life. You can't have all the experiences. It's not possible. So you can only have a set of experiences. And that set of experiences is now taking place in the form of your life, right? So another practical point of understanding is that there are an infinite number of experiences that you're not having, right? That's just a fact. Infinite number of experiences that you don't get to have. Are you going to grieve over those? Or are you going to appreciate and be grateful for the set of experiences that you do have? This set is your set. It belongs to you. Nobody can take it away. Swamiji gave me this little lecture one time. I've never forgotten it. It was at, you know, one of those moments where you need that kind of a lecture. So it's personally tailored to me. To be grateful for this set of experiences that you do have, that are given to you. These are yours. And nobody can take it away from you. This particular thing comes in handy for me at times, even nowadays. Nobody can take away from you what is yours in terms of your karma, in terms of what's due to come your way. You know, sometimes people, say some people can make your life really difficult. It always happens. It's always going to be. Nobody escapes it, right? It's how it is. There's always going to be, at some point, sometimes you'll have a little time off, but usually, there's going to be something there, someone or some situation that is making things difficult for you, you know, take away from you. You can feel, take away from you something that's very meaningful to you that you want. They have the power, you think. They have the power to ruin your life. To take away from you what is so important to you. This has got to happen to you at different times in your life, because different times of your life there will be things that are very important and they become threatened. And so then you feel, this person has the power, you know, to really screw up my life and to take this away from me. And so that's, you know, throughout my life that's happened to enough times for me not to like that. I mean, like enough times to be experienced in that. So, but what will come to me when I have a feeling like that, you know, is actually nobody can take away what is yours. Nobody can remove from you your prarabdha. What can get and does get removed and rubbed off, if not rubbed off really ruthlessly, are the things that are not yours and don't belong to you. And if you really analyze the situation of your life, you'll often see that the things you think you want but don't have, I would say like this, that often things that you think you want, how to say this, things that you want to want, it's very, very often not what you really want, but what you want to want or what you think you will want. What you think you will want, but very, very often it actually is not what you want right now. It's just that you're afraid that you will want it and you won't be able to have it because this person or that situation will stop you from having what you want. It gets complicated because the mind will project into the future and live in the future, you know, and worry about so-and-so happening and so-and-so happening, stopping me from being able to have what I want. But actually nobody can stop you from having what you want because the prarabdha that is unfolding is much greater than your will. The prarabdha, your will, your free will has to, and everybody's free will, has to operate within that prarabdha. Right? And so the prarabdha will push things, you know, against the will. Like, say you really want something, and you do want it, and so-and-so wants to stop you from having it because they don't like you, or whatever, some complicated, icky thing like that. But it is your prarabdha to go that route. What's going to happen is so-and-so, who doesn't want you to have that, is going to be mad. Because they won't be able to stop the unfoldment of your prarabdha, and so they will be upset about that. And on the other hand, you won't be able to stop the unfoldment of you, of their prarabdha, right? You know, say you think that you should have such and such, and they shouldn't have that. But actually, they should have that, and they move along, and then you get bumped out. You see what I'm saying? It's so sukha and dukkha. You know, when they say that taking this human birth, 50-50, 50% sukha, 50% dukkha, this is it. This is the sukha and dukkha. You know, because you're going along with your prarabdha unfolding, thinking that, you know, I see what they have and I see what they have and I would like this and I would like that, and you're tinkering with it. You're not just appreciating the prarabdha, the life that you have. You're tinkering with what you think you should have and what might be taken away from you and this obstruction and that obstruction. And your mind is worrying about it and bumping in this way and that way. So the mind gets upset. You know, things aren't as we always want them. So there's a lot of sukha and dukkha taking place. Things simplify. You know, things simplify once I'm just present with the situation at hand. You know, kind of recognizing that of an infinite variety of situations that I could have. I tell you that is infinite, right? And so out of those infinite, that infinite variety of situations that are possible, this is the situation that is here, right? And so it's this situation that I need to respond to. So that's kind of the trick. And Swamiji's told me before also, because his life can be so hectic, you know. But what he said, it's helped me too. He said, I just respond to the situation that's before me. And, I mean, that's a full-time job. It's a full-time job. Because there always is a situation before you, you know. And when you think, when you start realizing the advantages of settling into your own prarabdha and just responding to the situation at hand, life becomes very, very simple because you have your prarabdha. It's yours. Nobody can take that away from you. You know, it's you. So this, your prarabdha is your given place in this creation. You can just relax, and it's Bhagawan. Your prarabdha is Bhagawan. You see what I mean? So you can relax into that prarabdha and respond to Ishwara. You respond to the creation. Now, what happens to us is on top of that, we have what we call this jiva srishti. Jiva srishti means the projection of the jiva, right? Which is mithya jnanam, born of ignorance, this kartritvam and bhoktritvam, that mithya jnanam. That projection on top of the prarabdha, the collective prarabdha, the individual prarabdha, there's the jiva projection that's born of the doership, kartritvam, bhoktritvam, born of this ajnanam, of not knowing myself as the whole. And then this poor jiva is looking around deciding, you know, this would be best for me, and this would be best for me, this would be best for me, and maybe this isn't going to happen, and creates a, like a web. You get caught in this web of projection around, on top of, and tying into knots, the very simple life that is already here, simple, beautiful life that is already here and planned for you. So that's an unwinding, right? For the pundit, the one who has done this unwinding, right? This creation that's being experienced, my birth, my life, my death, your birth, your life, your death, the situation, this is all Ishwara. Right? And so here I am. It's a most extraordinary situation for you to have this life, which is Ishwara, and then to just be able to respond to it. But what if you're responding to it as Ishwara? That's really the jnani is the greatest bhakta, because always responding to this life as Ishwara and wondering about it. I mean, it's an infinite creation. It's Bhagavan, this the omniscience of this creation, you know, or the expression of this creation. You're walking through the expression of this creation, which is the expression of yourself as I am the whole, right? And so it's an incredible situation to be in. So instead of bungling it by trying to make it better, we can respond to Ishwara as it is. You know, and responding to the creation as it is, you do make it better. In other words, you're adding your own love and your own care to the creation, but that's a lot different than wanting it to be other than what it is. If you want it to be other than what it is, you can't respond to what it is. You see that difference? If you can respond to what it is, then you can help in whatever way is available. You know, the response can be a helping response. But what if you can't be with it as it is? Then you can't respond. You can't respond to it. You can just be butting up against it. That's the thing. So here, I didn't get my three verses, but that's all right. Asochan in Vishochas Tron Pratnyavadam Subhashase Gatasin Agatasinscha Nan Shochanti Panditaha. One other thing about this. Bhagavan starts teaching this with what's called a nunge. Nunge is a negative, like the Asochan that unnegates. Usually, you don't start a verse or a text with a nunge, with a negative like that. You know, just in the tradition. And so in some of the commentaries, there'll be a discussion on that. Why did Bhagavan start with Asochan, with a negative like that, you know? But here, the whole situation is around grief. So Asochan, that you need not grieve, is appropriate. And also in the beginning of the Mahabharata, it starts with a prayer to Bhagavan and to Sarasvati. So I'm just pointing that out. Swamiji talks about that quite a bit in his commentary. It's just interesting that this would be the thing. Why did Bhagavan start with, you know, a nunge, a negative there? Doesn't that kind of put a negative on the beginning? You don't start something with saying no, you know. But here in the context, it's so completely appropriate. And especially to think of Arjuna's situation, grief over somebody who is dead, to be able, or going to be killed, to be able to say you're inappropriately grieving. You know, this doesn't deserve grief. Such a huge statement. So this statement now that Krishna has to make Arjuna see why that's true, you know, to know why that's true, to know that he has to unfold the whole of Vedanta. So let's stop there. Om Purnamidah Purnamidam Purnat Purnam Dachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate
Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
The word prachinya a point of argument, is it?
It's the initial, like say if you take a logical syllogism, the first statement is the prachinya, like in, you know, fire on the hill.
Right.
There is fire on the hill, that's the prachinya. So here, the prachinya is you're grieving for that which does not deserve grief. That has to be proven. How could that be? That's aspirate ba. Boktritvam is enjoyership. And kartritvam is doership. So we'll say the nominative singular for kartra is karta. And boktra, bokta. So we say the karta and the bokta. The samsari is a karta and bokta. He's a doer and an enjoyer, right? And samsari comes from the substantive samsarin. So in ending, you haven't learned in ending nouns yet. In the nominative singular, there'll be a long e, samsari, right? But the actual word is samsarin. Just like jnani, jnanin. The actual word is jnanin. Nominative singular is jnani.
Is that word samsara the root sara?
No, samsara is the sra samyak saraha. Saraha becomes from sra, means to move. Samyak is that which moves really well. It goes on and on. It never stops. It's endlessly moving. Perfectly well done. Moving without stopping. Moves well.
The mind.
The samsara. Samsara is also just the used for transmigratory existence of the jiva. Also the fact that the creation itself is continually changing. But samsara implies the ignorance of the jiva. Otherwise you're talking about the jagat or the creation. You know, the manifestation of the creation or the vishwa, like that. But when we say samsara, we're talking about that the jiva who's suffering, you know, takes themselves to be a samsari. This becomes samsara to the samsari, right? When you take yourself to be something that is subject to death, then you're a samsari, suffering from the samsara. That, so you're suffering from that which is continually changing because you're identified with it.
So when we kind of incarnate, the Atma is like in the perfect kind of place.
The Atma doesn't incarnate.
Well, I'm just saying, isn't there right? Well, the Atma itself, okay. Because I'm kind of trying to understand, so if the jiva is ignorant, incarnates with that ignorance, avidya kind of factor, then at the same time, I was just thinking, the Atma factor inside of me knows the perfection. And then there's this, the mind is kind of trying to find out how the two actually, it seems like the whole life journey is like to make sense out of what we know intrinsically is perfect, but which we experience as imperfect. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And part of that is the ignorance that brings us where we're going, is that obviously. But
well, the conscious being that is the Atma isn't knowing anything. It's just pure consciousness. So the problem is that the mind, which is not away from that consciousness, but is subject to change and coming and going and all of that, that mind says, I am. the conscious being. Mm-hmm. And but what it means by that is, if I'm happy, then I, the conscious being, am happy. If I'm sad, I'm the conscious being, am sad. Right? There's no recognition of the changelessness of consciousness, the changelessness of myself, that I can say, the one who is sad is the one who is happy. I can say that. Then I understand the changelessness of a consciousness. Right? But say, I don't understand that. That's where the ahankara comes in. That means there's an identification of my being with what is coming and going, what is changing, as though I am that. In fact, to really understand it, you have to be able to say, that is me, but I am not that. Mm-hmm. It's like, say if you have a clay pot. Mm-hmm. The clay could say, you know, I am the pot. No, the pot is me, but I am not the pot. In the sense that my being is completely free of the pot. But the pot is not free of me at all. And that's the relationship I have with the world, in fact. That's the relationship I have with my mind. You know, I am it, but it is not me. Right? I'm completely free of it, but it is not free of me in any way. Just like the pot is not free of the clay. But the clay is completely free of the pot. Doesn't depend on it at all. Its being is not dependent. So I need to recognize, in terms of myself, mm-hmm. even though there is nothing that is away from me, there's also nothing that changes me. Mm-hmm. And so that viveka, that's why viveka is such a... The whole thing, in terms of self-knowledge, really rests on this viveka, this discrimination. Because if I can't make that discrimination between the changeless and the changing, I can't recognize myself. Then I'm a samsari. If that discrimination isn't there, then I am one with something that is changing, and that isn't true. So if the viveka doesn't come into operation, then I can't know myself, and I can't know that I am the whole. Because if I'm identified with anything that is changing, then I become a part. I don't become the whole, I become a part.
Okay. So the ahankaras, I just wanted to say the ahankaras is then becomes like the operating system of the jiva, right?
The ahankara, when we say ahankara, we're assuming an ignorant ahankara. Mm-hmm. But the ahankara for jnani, we say it's like a dugdha bija, it's there, it's operational, because I say I'm walking to the store or I'm thinking that, you know, but there's no sense that in reality my being is performing any type of action. Mm-hmm. Right? So even though the I is there, mm-hmm. it's there as mithya. Whereas for a samsari, the I and that identification is not there as mithya, it's there as the reality. I am this. There is no self that isn't subject to birth and death and change. You know? Sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm sad. You know, sometimes I'm healthy, sometimes I'm well. Sometimes I'm this, sometimes I'm that. There's no recognition of the one that is the constant in all of that.
But rather, I'm taking that on faith then, right?
No. You're taking it on faith until you know it.
Right.
Yeah.
Because, like, I mean, you give the example of the bhakti and the moment of death has the same experience as the jhani, has the same experience as the, what's the other one? As the atheist.
Oh, I see. You're taking that the self survives death on faith right
I'm
now.
So experienced, right?
No. Well, that might be for you, true for you now, but once yourself is recognized as changeless and the very relationship, like say, just in this room itself. In this room itself, you have the experience of the room through your sense organs and the body through your sense organs. You also have the experience of your mind or thoughts, emotions. You have the experience of the ahankara. You have the experience of being. You have the experience of consciousness. So all of that, That would be the totality of your experience that includes both the subject and object. Do you see what I'm saying? In this room.
Right.
Everything that you perceive, all of your thoughts, all of your cognitions, all of your emotions, yourself, the conscious being, the existence, all that's all kind of merged in together into one big ball of perception. That includes subject and object. Okay?
Right.
One big ball of experience, let me say. What about when you recognize the changelessness of the self, the subject that can, the you, that is not, cannot be objectified, and you recognize that you that cannot be objectified as being the very being of all that is, say you see that clearly, then there's no, if you see that clearly, it doesn't matter whether this body or this rug or this space or this universe is present or not. It can't change your being. It's impossible.
Right.
And so once you recognize that here and now that it's impossible, it's not about faith anymore. Because it doesn't matter even right here and now whether this universe is present or not. It has no impact on your being, and that's clearly recognized and understood. So if that's the case here and now, death is irrelevant. It doesn't have the capacity to change or to change that reality that you recognize here now. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So it's not a matter of faith. It's a matter of knowledge. And also, when you recognize the timelessness of yourself, what timeless means, and you recognize your being as timeless. Right, that's a recognition. Your being is timeless, but you recognize that. Timeless is timeless. Timeless doesn't have birth and death. It doesn't have a past and a future. Timeless is that which is free from time. And if you recognize yourself, that which is, and you recognize the timeless nature of it, means there's no past or present. There's no past, present, or future. There's only presence, actually. When you recognize that, then timeless is timeless, right? And so there's no borders for that. There's no birth or death. There's just being, the being that is. So say when you recognize yourself, the being that is, there's no way to make that different. You can't budget one way or the other because it's free from time. To be free from time, you, the being that you are, when you say I am that being, it cannot be an object within time. And yourself is the only thing, in fact, that you can't objectify as an object. Like, this is an object, this is an object, this body is an object, these clothes are an object, you are an object. That's all part of the Maya, part of the whole. The one thing that cannot be objectified is actually what this whole thing is. Right? The very substance of this whole thing, which is you. Your being is the one thing that cannot be objectified. And so what's so nice about that is, say you're sitting in meditation and just sitting with yourself, just being with yourself, you can't budge yourself. You can't budge yourself. You know, you can't objectify yourself. You can't change yourself. You are the one and only thing you can't do anything to. Everything else, of course, exists within time. And everything that exists within time exists within duality. They say in the tradition, there's four things you can do. Do something. And if you can do something, there's four things that can be done. Right? You can create something. It's called upajja. You can create something. You can reach something. You attain something. Like you can go somewhere to reach something. You can transform something, like make milk into curds. You can transform something. Or you can clean something. Samskarium, it's called. Like, say if you've got a... We'll do this more in the mundaka. It's going to come up next verse. Say if you have like an example is if you've got a brass pot and it's become tarnished. So you can shine all that tarnish off, clean it, you know. Or you can do rituals also for samskarya to remove papas, you know, to remove things that you've done or omissions. Certain things, like say you didn't do some rituals properly or something, you can do some karmas to clean that up, to purify it. So purificatory acts and rites and things like that for cleaning. You know, or transforming something, milk into curds type of thing. Or traveling, reaching something. Or making something, creating something, like making a pot from clay or building a house. These are the things you can do. But all things that you can do are done in time and space. Within duality, to do something, do something. Or you have to be within duality. Right? It also speaks to the finitude. Anything that you do, anything that you create, anything that you reach, all of that's taking place in time. It's all bound by time. It's all bound by change. So it all comes to an end. This is part of the argument they use for going to wanting to go to Swarga Loka. It's just like taking a vacation. You're spending your punya, and the punya runs out, then you come back. Because it's a karma. It's the results of karma. Karmas can't give you anything that's lasting. You know? But here, yourself is not a karma. Right? It's not something that you can do something to. You can't purify yourself. You can't reach yourself because you're already there. You can't purify yourself because you can't be objectified. You can't transform yourself because you have no parts, like milk turning into curds or something. You can't purify yourself because there's no objectification. There's no object. It's not objectifiable. So all of these things, you know, that we can do to an object, you can purify your body. I suppose you can transform it. You can dye your hair anyway. You can do certain things. You can have plastic surgery done. You can do things, you know, to alter it, to transform it. You can take it places, all of these type of things, you know. But what can you do? You can transform your mind. You can purify your mind. We talk about it. We do. We do all kinds of things to work on our body and work on our mind, to transform it, to purify it, to do this. Yourself, though, is not available for that. Yourself is not an object in the creation. You know, to be able to act upon it, to make it better or worse. In fact, that's a great thing. You can't make it better, and you can't make it worse. So you can relax. You know?
But to understand that I am the whole, you have to see the recognize the changeless and the changing.
That's right.
You have to recognize that somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you thought
that
really nice.
Yeah, and the Bhagavad Gita, those very words run all the way through the Gita. To recognize the changeless in the changing. And that is viveka. That's what I'm saying. Viveka is discrimination between two things. That's what viveka is. Two things that are appearing as though one. Right? And so, yes, it's recognizing the changeless within the changeless. The changeless within this body. The changeless within this mind. The changeless within these sense organs. The changeless within this creation. The changeless within all perceptions. The changeless, which is the very being of this whole creation. Yeah.
It doesn't seem that hard in some way to recognize the changeless in the changing, amidst the changing body, mind, sense organ somehow, you know. But somehow, I don't know why it seems impossible to recognize, not impossible, to recognize the changeless in the changing.
Well, you know what, I think we talked a little bit about this the last class you were here. If you go ahead and recognize, and you say, I do recognize myself as changeless in my body and mind and sense organs. The next step that can be helpful is then to put the body, mind, sense organs into the creation and recognize that this body, in your perception, this body is actually in your perception.
Yeah, I realized, and when you said put your being in the middle, that was really helpful because then I thought some point I said, yeah, you know, my mind and my sensory are as much an object of perception as anything at all.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But still, it seems to me that's not recognizing the changeless in the changing. That's differentiating the changeless from the changing. But it's not recognizing the changeless in the changing.
Maybe it's because, in a sense, the changeless is not in the changing, because the changeless is not objectifiable. Consciousness is not objectifiable. So it isn't entering into anything. So if you look at where's the changeless in there, you can't do like that. Yeah, you can't go like that. You know, let me see the changeless in there. Yeah. But there is nothing but the changeless. And so that's why I think in using either a dream or in the waking state, like right now, to practice using your imagination. Now, if you practice using your imagination, then say you kind of close your eyes so you forget about this world and you imagine a meadow, for instance, whatever that is, a nice imagination. Then you recognize that meadow is not apart or from the changelessness of your being. That's very experiential. So the changeless is that the meadow has no existence apart from your being. Right? So you pervade totally the meadow. In fact, you are the meadow. Right? The meadow has no being apart from you. So if you work with that in terms of just your own subjective imagination, and if you can experience the reality of that in reference to your subjective imagination, then if you're looking with your sense organs out into this room, for instance, and then recognize that your body is part of this room, your thoughts are part of this room, everything that you experience is part of this room, then you can experience the same fact that there's nothing in this experience that is away from your being. It's the Dehatma Buddhi. It's this identification with a physical body is so strong that it makes you experience reality, experience being through your body and out your eyes, kind of like that.
It's like a filter.
But in reality, that isn't your experience. Not really. You just haven't noticed the fact that in actuality, your being is the presence, the very stuff of this whole thing. There's nothing in this room, in the perception of this room, that is away from your being at all. There is no, you can't, like say for instance, looking at the room through your sense organs, through your eyes, you're not looking at being, right? You're saying, oh, you can't say, oh, look at the being. You're not looking at the being through your eyes, because being is not objectifiable. Being is only experienced by you as amness. Okay, so let's make the amness that we experience, let's call it isness. What difference does it make, amness or isness? If you say isness, then you'll recognize that the isness, which is my amness, is the isness which the whole room is enjoying. There is no experience of isness away from my amness. In fact, there is no imness, isness. There's only amness. There's only am. There is no is. There's only amness. That's it. Because for is, when you think of is, you're objectifying it as though you could look at it. And amness cannot be objectified. But we objectify it through self-ignorance, saying, this amness what I experience is amness, and this all is. But we're not seeing any is. You're not experiencing any is. You're only experiencing the amness, which is the isness of all of this. And so that's then when you see that in quotes, right? When you see that, then you recognize, because now you've come to recognize your own amness, and there's nothing away from it. So the amness, which the whole room enjoys, this my amness, me.
So the sense of any difference in amness is
that goes away completely.
Yeah. Okay. And where's that born from again? That sense that there's a difference in amness?
Well, it's because if I have a Dehatma Buddhi, mm-hmm. I say, I am. And it stops here. Right? And then I see that you are. So right immediately what happens is that the existence experience, which is amness, you know, is just superimposed on all of these objects. And then in language, I am, you are, it is. But the are is an am. That's language that is used to, it's a verbal, it's a verb. The verb to be, which is now being declined in reference to he, she, or it. And you, right? I, you, he, she, or it. I am, you are, he, she, or it is. Right? And so that's all just speaking of to the superimposition. Really, there's only one being, right? And then in terms of third person, the being, it is, he is, she is. In terms of second person, you are. In terms of first person, I am, right? That's language. But the reality is that there's only one amness, which is non-objectifiable, which is Brahman. That's the truth of it. And I am that Brahman.
So this feeling of I am is that Brahman. It's just that.
Yeah.
And it's not any different than, if it's only one, then it's not any different than your sense of amness as well.
My sense of amness is your sense of amness.
Yeah.
There's no dual, there's no, not somebody sensing amness. There's nobody sensing amness. Mm-hmm. Amness is its own sense.
Yeah. Okay.
Right? And there's only one of them.
Isn't that strange?
But I think what's strange is that we think it's all different.
No, last week you mentioned
what's strange is that we think it's strange.
That I thought was very helpful regarding by Ravi.
By Ravi.
Where, and I never put it together before, but you said it was the dispassion, you know, as sort of negative, you know, when you think dispassion,
oh, yeah.
You think giving up things. But that sense of the fullness and the operational sense of fullness.
Yeah.
And the fullness is the amness. I mean, that's...
yeah, that it is. And then the fullness is the amness. It means I am. That amness is the beloved. You know, we have to work also not to objectify these words into some abstract meaning. Like, for instance, the word awareness can become objectified, and then it becomes kind of like a cold word, like space. You know, like space is all pervasive. But space is a cold word. I wouldn't want to be space. You know? You know, it's all pervasive and everything.
There's no satisfaction.
Yeah. I mean, that's not me.
The word becomes something you look for.
Yeah, the word becomes something removed from my being.
Or even existence, right?
Yeah.
Same thing.
That's existence. Who? I don't want to be existence. But that's because we've denuded it of we're objectifying it into something away from me. You know, we're actually, there is nothing more beloved to you than your own being, who you are. You know, your being. It's not. It's the. You can't take your being away from your body and love your body. Have you ever seen a dead body? It's really interesting. You know, when the life force goes out of that body, that person is gone. That is a carcass there.
Yeah.
It's a carcass. It's like a lizard shedding its skin. The person is not there. It's this empty carcass. It's kind of interesting to, you know, if you, just a little aside, if a person moves out of a home, you know, like when we were selling my parents' home, and we moved all the furniture out, everything was moved out, and for a few months, you know, that house was sitting there, poor thing, all by itself. Nobody was living there. And you could watch it. It's as though the life force is pulled out. There's no life there anymore. It just starts to kind of crumble in a way. And the body, when the life force goes out of the body, there's a dead carcass, a dead skin there. You know, Krishna talks about this in two verses from now. And this is like, it's like a dress or something. It's old and it's time to shed it off.
I love that he uses like, the breathing is gone or not yet gone, because that's like such a dramatic thing when you see a dead body, right? That
yeah.
There's no breath. It's there's just no, this and there's nothing there.
Yeah. That's an amazing experience. Yeah. Amazing.
There's no fire also. No breath and no fire.
Yeah.
And then you also sense that the person that was in that body is not...
is gone.
It's so funny, and then there's this whole thing about the body is dead. I mean, the whole identification with the body is just so humongous.
It's humongous, yeah. But, you know, I mean, it is the center for the sukshma sharira. So the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, is embodied here fully using the sense organs which are embodied in this upadi, right? And the mind, the brain and all. So, I mean, you're going to have much more identification with it than with the chair. You know?
It's almost like...
Yeah, I hope so.
That's why the viveka, though, that's why the viveka is so... Because the identification is there, that's why that viveka is necessary. Without the viveka, you can't recognize your soul, the freedom of your being, the changelessness of your being. The mind needs to have that discrimination has to take place. And it's very, very subtle. You know, it's not... And one more example they use is, you know, in a bird bath filled with half milk and half water. The Hamsa bird. Right? The Hamsa bird goes and sits on that bird bath and sucks out all the milk. That's what the Hamsa bird is famous for. Also, that Hamsa...
Is that really doing that?
Well, that's the myth. I don't think it's really doing it. But it's just a story. But to show kind of the subtlety, you know. And Hamsa means soham. You know, it's a famous word. Swamiji loves that word, Hamsa. Because backwards it's soham.
Wow.
And I am he. So it's a mantra also. And that soham mantra is, you know, when you do nididhyasana, soham, he am I is literally with the soham, soham, soham. It's once you have this vision, then that mantra, for nididhyasana, is very powerful because it identifies the Atma with Brahman. It means I am the infinite, I am the whole. That's what you're saying, basically. It's a very beautiful mantra to do because it just brings in everything. So Hamsa is soham. Hamsa, soham. If you take the two words and reverse them. Kind of.
Maybe I should be calling you all day long.
All right, let's start.
Oh, it's a good class. Yeah, beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.